What's up, everybody? Happy Wednesday. Welcome back to the DeCristo Series podcast. Today, we got another Mobile Hunter Roadshow Q&A segment. This one is from our Wisconsin event last year, and we had a pretty awesome group of some Midwest killers, and we get into all sorts of topics and wormholes. Everything from arrow flight to setting personal goals, dumb industry trends. One of our roadshow speakers at this event is a canine handler, and we even get into some of the specifics behind dogs and scent and how that can relate to whitetails. All right, let's get this thing rolling. Enjoy.
There you have it. That is
really getting jacked up.
One thing you could bank on, your thermal is a constant. Yep. Wind is not. Wind is, it blows hard, it blows easy, it changes direction. Picture your thermals as being just a big blob, a mess of air, and it's just moving slowly and consistent. Even though other winds are fighting against it, pulling it different directions, that thermal is your most important because it's going, even with wind blowing constantly on it, as it slows down, there's molecules that get in that mass of air that move. And like I say a lot of times, anybody can play the wind, get on a trail right, it's that thermal creep that's going to kill you on a big one, because that there's small tiny molecules on there that them big ones just seem to pick up, and you want to play that as much as you can with your wind direction. And sometimes it's impossible to do, and the reason why it's tough to do is because them whitetail are playing that too. When they're sitting down in that bottom and they got thermals coming from every direction, they're there for a reason. They're so on a ridge or something, or on an edge, you want to get up on the opposite side where you're wind's going to blow away, because everything in that main ravine will be going in there. So just remember that the thermal's a constant. It's going to be there in the morning and in the evening, and it could be harder and stronger, but it's a constant. It just pictured as like liquid just flowing in those directions, and it's constantly going to go. So if that helps you.
Yeah. I've had it with no wind with the powder, and you throw milkweed and it's just gone.
No. And don't get discouraged. Like, I know a lot, I've talked to guys before, they're like, oh, well, like, I can't find any more milkweed, or like, I don't have any in my area, especially in the Southeast, it's not a prominent thing for us. You can do really well with like really fine cotton. I don't like using like cotton balls specifically because it's a heavier cotton, but like, if you pull like the cotton off of like cotton swab for your ears, it's super fine and will float like milkweed will.
Cattails, so, too.
Cattails work really
that
good
works
in
really
a pinch,
good.
Too.
I've used that if I forgot it.
Yep.
Grab one and crimple it up in your hands, and it floats really good.
Yep.
So a lot of times, even the milkweed you won't need if you figure this out. So if you're on a field edge and there's just the slightest gradual downward slope to the woods and it's heading downhill, you know in your mind, you don't need the milkweed to know that when the low light comes and it starts cooling off, there's a mass of air that, even though it's blowing right for you, how you're set up, is going to be constantly coming down that hill in that way. So play that all in your scenario. Play it before you even use milkweed. Just learn that that's what it does, and then you manipulate the wind on top of that. You'll be better off, I think.
Do you still hunt permanent sets even though you try and be mobile and using the LWCG setups? Definitely. I think this is a – I'll kick it off, but – I think that a lot of people overlook, like, why make it harder on yourself? If you can benefit from a permanent set, and it's a good spot, and it's where the action's happening, like, yeah, hunt that set if it's hung. Like, you don't have to hang that time. The most important thing, I would say, is just being in the right area. But, yes, I still do hunt permanent sets. I'll move those permanent sets. Some you don't have to move because they're always good.
We probably got 80 sets on a property that are permanent, and hunt them very little. But when you do hunt them, I would suggest, I don't just dive in a stand because it was good a year ago. I literally go look at that spot before I'll get one of those. And if it's hot, then you got a mobile set already there that's set in, and you hunt it. Don't just because there's a stand there go jump in it, and it was good in the past or good in years past. At that time of year, it might not be. You just might burn yourself a day. So, you guys do anything up in that northern stuff with permanents at all, or is it all mobile completely?
No, I've got a permanent stand that I leave alone most of the year. It's a perfect split on my property. Mm-hmm. With some thick bedding, like Conon Ridge, and when the rut comes.
That's the spot, huh?
They're always coming through that.
Yeah.
Area. And they don't go on the regular trails.
Right.
They come on the main trail. And so I leave that stand over.
Yeah, we got a couple sweet spots like that too. That there every year, it's going to turn on, and there's going to be a good spot. I still like to look. I can't stand. I'll be in a tree, jump in a spot like that, and I'll be taking my binoculars looking for some scrapes or some sign. I got to see some fresh stuff. I'll be up there thinking, is this ice cold? Am I wasting a day? So that way, I like to kind of take a look at it.
Spots at all. Hunt year to year, especially good primary scrape. I mean, there are only so many really good spots, even in, you know, big woods country. So, I mean, a lot of those, and I ordered a bunch of, like, I left XOP long sticks, like the top.
Oh, ready
two.
To go.
So I left the top two there, and then I kind of used my mobile two to get up to those sticks. So I had kind of the top half preset. And then that could let me spread my equipment out more, and then I wouldn't have to set it up every single time. But, I mean, a good spot's a good spot. So there's no use not hunting a good spot, so you can hunt an average spot. Yeah, you can't overhunt it.
Well, there's something to that, too. So here's my thought on that. When a spot's red hot, get on it and stay on it until it burns out. Yeah, do not backpedal. I had guys that hunt spots that were red hot, and they thought they were overhunting them, and then they don't hunt it anymore, and it's still the shit's going on right where we're at. So you gotta just redesign and go with it.
Andre, when you were trying to get access to private property or on big bucks in Wisconsin, how did you go about doing that? What would you look for?
Well, first of all, you look for a spot that's got a big buck, and then you gotta crack the nut of getting into it. So. My daughter's here. I used her as bait one time to try and get in when she was like 3 years old, real cute little kid coming up and asked permission. Guy told me that kid's not getting in this ground. But there are spots that are typically good. And you know how Wisconsin is. Everybody's hunting somewhere. There's probably pretty much permission on there. So when you ask, you're polite. Don't show up at hunting season, you know, in your camel clothes. Try and get access to these spots earlier. You know, be polite about it, ask permission, ask if they can do you a favor. Maybe you're hunting an adjacent property. You can throw a name of, you know, yet you're on a neighboring property and the buck that you've been hunting is kind of crossing over yours. You think I can get over there for a day or something. Get to know these people and then leave it open for next year. So if it's already got guys hunting, fine. You walk away. You mind if I stop back next year? That leaves it open. And then it's just like anything. You're trying to sell something. Going in blunt is tough, but keep it open and keep on it, and that's what kills big deer. The skills trade is there, but if you're on the pieces in a property that got the big deer, your success numbers are just going to go through the roof, and that's what makes or break it.
Do you look for anything specific on those properties? Like, if you're like, oh, man, I know that 50 acres is prime for holding a big deer.
No, it'd be so if you hear something from you know, some of the local cops, they'll give you leads. Some of the guys that aren't hunters, bus drivers, or trying to get permission. I used to do is I'd write a list of everybody I know who they know, and then start branching out and asking, hey, do you got any property in this area, just to get leads to more ground. So it's tough to get coming cold and get on pieces, but you'll be surprised at how many pieces you think you'll never get on. And you just go knock on the door and ask, and they let you on. Well, we gun hunt, but you're welcome to bow hunt. So it still doesn't hurt to ask. Guys are still given permission. And then there's properties you just can't get on. They're just locked up. That, you know, there's guys hunting. So shining, hearing about a big deer from somebody.
Leads, man.
Leads. You can't. You got to have the leads, you know.
Me and
ask questions from people, just even locals and the gas stations, and don't even like act like you're a hunter. I just act like I'm a nature watcher, you know, just look at the birds and, you know,
big rack sticker on the back.
I took all those off. Yeah.
Blood all over your boots.
You talking about how you were at the bar and that drunk guy said,
did you? That was a freaking story.
You shined him on the way out.
Yeah, so I'll give a quick one for that because that's a really good story. So there's a guy in a bar every night talking about this buck that he's seeing. It's out on Highway C and H there, and he's got his hands as wide as he can, you know, freaking one stone that we leave unturned. And all week he was ranting and raving about it. And for some reason, me and my brother up there hunting, and we decided we're going to hunt late and then just drive straight home. So we're going to leave the cabin, and we're going to go out the back way. So on the back way, it was the day before gun season. That was the last hunt. It was closed. and we shined on the way out. And we shined a buck that was 30 inches wide, if I ever seen one that freaking wide. And we looked at each other, and we're shining, and there was the two freaking square signs, the H and C, and it's like that deer was out there every freaking night. And if we'd have just, now when I hear a story like that, matter of fact, Alan Bliss has got a guy that's just got him a lead. He says it's 28 inches wide and all this. So even if he's wrong and it's 20 inches wide and they're 10 inch tines, go look at that spot because, you know, just don't leave anything unturned. Follow them leads, and you'll get lucky sometimes with some really big deer.
It's been talked about a lot, but when you get to a point to where you're looking, for a certain caliber deer, like you've said it forever, like you can't kill what's not there. And if you're in an area that's real tough and it's so scarce to find what you're looking for, like you gotta go elsewhere. Like, I mean, you can sit there and you can tough it out and grind it and try and make it happen and pull a rabbit out of the hat, but ultimately you gotta know what you want and you gotta go get it. Like, and if that means going to a different area, whether it's a county over, 10 minutes down the road, a different state, like, it's all what you're trying to do for yourself.
And maybe a show of hands, how many guys here are just, you're not out for a specific buck, you just like to shoot a nice buck during the season of your, so that's a whole different scenario. You want to get on a property, you want to be more of a rut hunter, you want your numbers in your favor, that's a whole nother animal or way to attack a season.
Yeah.
If
yeah.
you're looking something as bigger than you've ever shot before, or you want to take it to the next level, that's a whole nother direction you got to go.
That's where I think people overlook a plan in whitetail hunting and mobile hunting too. Like, I mean, if you're just out there to have a good time, you know, it's great. But if you setting goals for yourself too can be powerful, and knowing what you're trying to do, like you said, if it's just, hey, I want to get out and I want to, you know, learn to read sign better, and I want to kill a good buck. Like, just, if that's it, you know, on this, then awesome, you know. But at the same time, you still got to put yourself in those areas that you're going to find that buck that's good to you or whatever. So I think having a plan is huge, and it's something that people most of the time don't have, and they just, you know, kind of go in willing.
You can even look at, like, county by county records. So, like, there's tools out there to help if you just want to get, like, a general idea of where I need to be in my state. Like, Onyx lets you see the Boone and Crockett frequency of harvests county by county. You can also go look and find out, like, state record, you know, information. And you know, like, you know, for example, if I'm looking at somewhere close to hunt near me when I live in the southeast, Pulaski County, Kentucky had 7 Boone and Crockett shot there last year. Mm-hmm. Like, that's...
There's another
small county too.
It's right. A small county.
So, but there's a flip side to that too.
You know. So
okay. So here's how we look at that. So a lot of those counties that are Pike County, Illinois, Buffalo County, Wisconsin, every serious hunter in the world is hunting there because it has big class deer. Every deer shot there is going to record books, and people are knowing about it. There are counties where there are farmers, dirt fur farmers, that shoot huge bucks that nail them up on their wall, that don't give a shit about what we give a shit about, and don't leave those stones unturned either, because there's counties that have some of the top-end bucks. They're not in volume or numbers, but they still can produce good animals. So they are where they are, right?
That comes into another question, too, that's in here, is, like, you know, how do you go about finding a new piece of property or knowing you're in the right area in an out-of-state environment or something like that? And that's where I think it comes, like,
it's a tough nut, man.
It's hard, you know, and that's where I always come back to leads and exhausting your avenues before you just pull up Kansas on a map and know nothing about it. Like, who do you know from Kansas? Do you know anybody? Can you get any, like, that to me is so important, because it's like, it's such a needle in the haystack, but at the same time, you know, you have to also take into account, I think, that depending on, once you've established what you're in seek of, what you're looking for, you know, that's going to define how tough this is going to be. Like, if you're looking for, you know, X or Y, but, you know, aerial scouting and all that. But that's where, like, what Jake was saying is, if you're completely blind, yeah, that's a good, or I know a good friend of mine, Byron, he doesn't look at record books, but he looks at how large the counties are and how many registered hunting licenses were sold in that county, or how many just registrations in general, not bucks. So he's an accountant, so he's a data man, so he's all about that stuff. So he does all that, which can help you get in an unpressured area at least. But, you know, then finding the deer, I don't know if you got any other tips on that, but, and if he's got tips, like...
The right 10 acres instead of the wrong 3 square miles,
but that's the
right?
thing. So the question is, how do you go about locating out-of-state hunting ground you're not familiar with? So
they can be everywhere, like that's what Andre was saying. I think for me,
that's public,
being an out-of-state guy, like I'm looking for... If I'm going entirely blank into it, like I'm going to hunt North Dakota soon, and I've never been to North Dakota. I don't know anything about it. I'm just looking for, like, habitat types that I know might or could hold a deer. That way, when I get there, I can scout it. So, like, instead of just going to, not that a giant, vast, 1,000-acre cornfield with two trees in it won't hold a giant deer, but if I'm going to spend my time scouting somewhere, it's going to be somewhere with a lot of edge, maybe a creek bottom, something that I feel, you know, has the higher possibility of holding a deer. You know, and I'm whittling down two or three of those spots and then going from there within a county that I know could produce a bigger buck.
Do you have anything on that? Or?
I mean, it's the time of year, too, because like we went through this. We hunted North Dakota the last 3 years for the opener, so beginning of September. So the hardest part is to find one to kill, and that was where, like, we were basically, we'd go and we'd stalk and glass in the mornings, and if we jumped a good one, then fine, because at least we know that, okay, this woodlot's worth spending time in, because you end up, if you're chasing your tail and hunting a place where one doesn't live, that's, I mean, your 6 days can go away in a hurry, so you're almost better, I'd say, especially early in the year, if you do an early trip, being super aggressive, if you bump one, that's awesome, because at least you know where to concentrate your next 5 days. Because if you never bump one or never see one, you're just chasing your tail, bumping from spot to spot. And that's kind of why we decided to go to Nebraska this year, because we're thinking, well, if we can see further and glass more, then hopefully we can spend all our time early on finding one and then hunt one down from there.
So when you guys are doing like we're going to do a couple weekend hunts, how long are you guys staying in the stand before you get down and move? Because it sounds like you guys are moving a lot throughout the day just to get out of something. Is that kind of your guys' game plan then? When you go unlimited time, is just to get out and keep moving?
Everybody's probably going to be different here, but I'm a 2.5 hour in the morning guy. Same in the evening probably majority of the year. And then when it gets into the rut or something, there might be a little longer sits or pre-rut.
Yeah, I mean, during the rut, I sit all day, pretty much every day. That just doesn't bother me, and I'm not really hunting destination areas, and we're just travel corridors, and you know, if you sit there long enough and you're in a good area, something's probably going to come by. But then early in the year, I'm not going to sit all day early in the year. I'm going to be super aggressive and then try to get it. So you have to kind of evolve depending on the time of the year.
They're not moving much early, so it doesn't make sense to...
Yeah, that was the one. Like, if you weren't within like 100 yards of where they're bedding, like this time of year, you have no chance.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. Sometimes it's way less running late in the evening. You know, get that last like hour, depending on where it's at too. Like if I'm, I'll try and play. Like, you know, we look at. I'm not a huge like 100% rock solid moon phase guy. It is a thing, and it's 100% accurate, but I'll try and let, if anything, I let that dictate my lengths of sit. Now, they're all short, probably. Like, even the longest sit is going to be short compared to, like, the average guy. It'll be a couple hours, but I'll try and time that to where I'm hunting and what I know the moon phase is doing. So if I'm way deep back and I'm anticipating, like, it taking a long time for deer to get back there, I'll still get in there at that time. But you might have to wait to get that movement. Like, you know, that might be a 9 o'clock movement. To whereas if I'm hunting a food source right in the morning, I might, right after that 7:15, I might be down. You know, I mean, and then like Dieter said too, time of year, you know, there's, as it creeps later and these bucks get more squirrely and like, I mean, cold fronts and stuff like that and just rut activity, you kind of got to, I mean, you know, what is an old thing like, I remember back in the day when I would kind of be like, oh, man, I don't know if I should get down. Or just like, sit until you're not seeing anything. I mean, and if you're in a real...
Half-hour rule.
Yeah, I mean, it's if you haven't seen
you
anything...
You see something, you sit a half an hour. See something again in a half hour, you sit another half an hour. That was the kind of a rule of thumb type of thing.
If you're doing, like, short trips, it doesn't hurt to scout a lot more than you sit, too, because you could just be wasting your time sitting in that stand hoping for something. You would be 100%. Driving around right at daybreak looking in fields and trying to catch a deer and like, okay, there's public on the back side of that. And you can kind of look and be like, okay, he may be bedding here, and then you can start getting close to him. Yeah. And then you start sitting a little bit longer, you know? Like,
I would definitely say the biggest I think back to years ago when I was like hunting weekends only, like, and I only got out Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Like, I would leave work, jet out of state. It sucked because it was like I'd spend that first 2 days figuring out what was going on, and then I'd be in the game for like one day, like, and then I'd leave, and then I'd come back the next week and it'd be the exact same thing. But it always worked. It always ended up because I wouldn't just go, like he kind of mentioned before, don't just go throw a sit at somewhere, especially when if you only got $3 in your pocket and you got to eat, like, you almost got to like think like, oh shit, okay, what should I spend this on? You know, in a kind of a, you know, versus just, you know, buying a $2 candy bar, I guess. But so, yeah, so that can be more challenging. At a time like November, though, I mean, honestly, I might think that, you know, time in the tree out there, as long as you're in a decent spot, might benefit you a little bit more.
Downtown Milwaukee, right by Summerfest, at 12 noon one year, it would have been the spot to set up your stand. You could have killed a monster buck that ran right by that. That's the rut.
Yeah.
So anything can happen any time of the day at that time of year.
So, yeah.
Question on scouting. How do you know when it's too much scouting the time of year? You know how things change during the year. They're here early and then they're there later on. Depends on,
I'm always scouting. There's never could be, in my opinion, you can never scout too much. So I'm constantly looking.
So like in the morning when you get out of your tree.
You're clean. You're fresh. You can go and do your poking around. Pick your next move or your next spot, and then.
You can see where actually movement. Hey, they're moving through here.
Yep. Or you go look at new spots or new areas, and then you jump on them. So.
Touched, because we have a disagreement with my son.
Right?
So you
should
walk in the woods.
Well, how many acres do you have?
Yeah,
whatever the acres is, it's like checking traps. Yeah. The deer I killed this year, I walked that wood line 3 times in that week, and I walked it the 4th time, and it freaking lit up. Monster rubs, jumped right on it, and killed a buck. If I wouldn't have kept walking that same and scouting that same area, I would have never known that happened.
I have, though, on the contrary, though. I mean, like, I think, like you mentioned, you got to be a little bit at least strategic depending on your property, because I've hunted with other people that have completely screwed up a 40-acre block of timber just because they were constantly badgering it, like, and just in there every day. But I don't think, you know, so, and I talk to a lot of people that are timid to scout a 10-acre sliver of property in between, like, and I get that, be timid, but this is what I tell them. You have to find out. So you got to check it out. Like, you have to. Otherwise, you're never going to know. But, I mean, at the same time, you got to be able to capitalize when you find out. If he's in there and you're not capitalizing on it, but you just keep missing him and bumping him out, yeah, he might leave. Like, I mean.
I personally, I have 80 acres, 240s and a 40 to the side. And there's certain areas that I don't go in. Mm-hmm. It's so thick, and I know they're better. If I stay away from certain areas, I would just leave it for balance, because I can't really hunt it so thick in there. Right. Briars, and you couldn't even walk through there. So I think that don't you have to leave certain areas alone?
Some guys do.
You're going right in there.
Fuck.
What?
I'm going right in there. If that buck's in there and ain't coming out, I'm going in and getting them. That's just the way I've always hunted. And you can't, I still believe you can't burn a whitetail out of his home range. I've seen it too many times. They'll come back. I've had guys telling me that, you know, the buck you said we can't burn out, they've seen it 2 miles away during gun season running on some guy's ground. I said, where did it end up 2 days later? Right back in the sanctuary that you let. This guy let a world-class deer on his property grow up, grow old, and die in a little sanctuary like that. I wanted to just cry. I want it so bad to just go in there and at least take a shot at it, man, because it's living in there. You got to get in the game if you want to get them. So that's just my opinion. I've just been a little more aggressive.
And I think
over and over the same big buck. He was there for 3 years. And we had the camera in there.
Kingpin.
See that?
We never went in there, and the neighbor ended up shooting during the shooting.
Yeah, and I think the time and the rate at which they come back too is going to vary.
Yeah, there's a whole different. And then they leave on their own.
Well,
during
and
the
that's
rut,
the
right?
thing. You talk about different. That deer grew up there, was established there, was probably a dominant deer. You got to realize bucks come in and go out of properties all the time too. Not every deer is a sole homebody. I do believe that's right. Like you said, but that deer has got to be like vested in that spot, which typically they are if they're there. But look at all the subordinate deer that could be giant deer, but they're not dominant, that come in and out, and they're pushed in and out, and
they just cruise.
I mean,
aimlessly.
They might have a
those big old deer like to sit themselves in a spot.
Yeah, but like you said, you can't if they're there, you gotta try and hunt them. Otherwise, you're never gonna.
I hunt the perimeter, the edges as much as I can, and if they don't cooperate, then you go on. If you got that, if you know where they're bedded, that's the most important piece of information. Try and get them trickling in and out of that. But if they ain't cooperating, then you just got to go for broke. It's all going to do is screw up a couple days, and he's going to end up in there. And that sounded like he had a homebody there. And then there's, like he was talking about, nomads that they might have three different major areas that they bed for a few days. Those are almost... unless you get aggressive and you stack them all into one spot, they're almost impossible. Try it sometime. Take a ping pong ball under three freaking cups and try and pick that one ball under there. It's almost impossible to pick the right spot they're bedded. So you either load it or you know it. And knowing that they're there is just gold, because now you know how deer come in and out of there. You can manipulate that, and you know they're in there. So that's all the points are in your favor, you know.
So are you more aggressive on
So now it's like a big mess out there. That's what I hear the comments all the time. Now everybody's running around like Andre on these places moving shit. So if I was the hunting public ground, the major time everybody gets out of their stands, I'd be sitting through that. So when everybody does a big drive in and out of there for lunch. And spots that are that beat up, I had a state record buck pinned down a piece of public land one year. I almost killed him. And the next year, the word got out he was there, and there was like 8 cars there, 6 bait piles, and just... freaking like a zoo. I probably should have hung it out and hunt it, because the deer hung it out and stayed in that 80, and a guy killed that deer in that 80 during a rut following does into a bait pile. So I'm a guy like probably a lot of you guys. I don't like a lot of people around. When I do all the boogering up I do and all the scouting and that, I know what I did. If he's running around the same chunk of woods I am, I don't know what the hell he did or what he boogered up. But if you got your own piece and your own land and you can just read the sign... We had one year, we got a section of land. Every buck on our property was up a draw with a doe that was going to heat on the property I was hunting. And I basically even said to him, I said, you need to get on this side, because there ain't nothing on any of this property but right here. It's all here. And for what, two and a half, 3 weeks? Just stacked in there and not a deer anywhere else. So you could have wasted a week bouncing around on all this stuff. There's tons of good land, tons of great stands that big deer have been killed out of in the past. You could have jumped in those and hunted them, but for the guy that went poking around and found a doe that went in heat early, that's where you want to be. And then sign didn't lie. It was there, you know. Just pounded trails and deer pounding there. So, and that happens on public land, too. And when the rut comes in and there's a doe going in heat, forget about them big bucks worried about you. They ain't the least bit worried about you. They're going after those does. Manipulate those spots, go after them, and then bucks will follow through. They don't even give a shit if you're there.
Cody and I talk about this all the time, but like I probably spend 80% of my season on public, and my first thing when I'm looking at a piece of public land that I want to get after is looking at unorthodox access. So like most of the guys, even a guy who's like really being mobile and hunting, usually they're still going to go in the convenient way, and then they may get mobile or may move from there. If you, like the deer that I shot last year, I shot because I was parking on the off-ramp of an interstate. No one else was parking there. They, you know, I made my car look like I just broke down and I walked in.
You see my truck on the outside? Yeah.
But it worked. There were deer. I saw like 30 deer in 2 days there, and on the third day I shot that buck. So the reason was because I knew where all the other pressure on the property was, and those deer were pushed up against that interstate, and they were moving and eating and living their best life, like right there. And I could control like I could control the access and the pressure, and I knew that I was the only one there, and I knew where I'd been the day before, and I could just work my way through that. So if you look at those access points, you're breaking down something on X, usually you can see those little white sand or gravel parking lots around a piece of public. Just start pinning those jokers, and then when you get there, just do a lap and drive around and see how many of them are there.
Or if you've got a 40 acres with 40 guys on it, move on.
Yeah.
Go somewhere else.
That too.
Save yourself some headaches and time, unless there's a big one in there.
Do you think ATVs have a big impact on going to the woods and all that? I don't.
Mm-hmm.
My neighbor used to run quality deer management, and every evening he was afraid someone was going to hunt his land.
Well, he's pushing them all out.
Oh, they'd be.
I think.
Deer would be going die by right and left.
I drove by a bedded.
You want to shoot a big deer on your property? Don't run that ATV in there.
I drove by a Boone Crockett 8 two times scouting on a bike. I came by him. He didn't bust out of there, but I spotted him, and I got caught where I had to literally couldn't get out and go another way. So I had to go by him again. So I wanted to play like dumb, like I'm looking this way. He let me drive by him again. I was hunting a different deer, and the last day of the season, I went in and killed that buck in that bed. That he didn't give a shit. That was it was a big, mature animal, and I'm sure I pushed a bunch of deer around while I was driving around. But yeah, that deer, he thought he had the game figured out. You know, he was just getting ready to bust out.
Yeah, and he was watching you. Had you stopped?
Yeah, or made eye contact. Boom, he'd have been off there. So,
it's also about what they're used to. So, like in North Carolina, we have a lot of ag country like here. So, if there's farmers and farmhands on a property and they just drive constantly and they're like,
and they get accustomed to it. Yeah.
We've got a lease that's like 800 acres and most of it's ag, and it's just all farmhands, working tobacco fields and corn fields, and they're on it every day. And those deer will just stand in the field and watch them drive by.
Yeah, they'll get used to. Man, we used to hunt next to a shooting range, and ARs.
The police shooting range for the whole southeastern Wisconsin. My property was next to it.
Just blast, and you would think like, oh man, they wouldn't tolerate that.
I never got used to it.
Well,
the deer did.
But them
jump out of your tree and shit. All of a sudden,
they grow up there. They're used to that. They hear it.
Yeah.
A lot of guys stop at the water's edge.
Yep.
Whereas there's back places, and a lot of the state game in our area is that's not too good. You see, here's the way I'm private, so I don't care about it. A lot of guys that stop there. And there's bucks in the back.
Here's the thing. Like, I think there's a lot of people, everybody thinks they're going 110%, right? And everybody else thinks everybody else is going, oh, and these guys are. The percentage of guys who are actually putting in the work and the time to do things like that and going and finding these spots and actively throughout the course of a season is very small. It's very small. So I think, like, even, you start to think, like, oh, yeah, like, this is going to get heavily pressured. This is so many guys that got even good deer. Bow out walking out a hill for the fourth time. Like, they're like four times and they're done. Like, four times going in there. And so you might, that's the thing too, it might be a misconception, like first week of season, first couple days, like you go to that piece and there's 10 trucks there, wait that out a second. A lot of that stuff will fizzle out pretty quickly too, because, and that's what we were just talking to a couple of people before about, that's what the custom gear setup is about in my eyes. It's about how efficient can you be to keep yourself in the game for the long haul, because the easier you make it for yourself, the easier you can transport your stand in, and the easier that task is, the longer you're going to go and you're going to outrun everybody else. What is the dumbest hunting trend you've ever seen?
Can I get this one?
Yeah, go for it.
The scent shuttle. Remember it, anybody?
What?
Steel ball with a wick in it, and you had a wrist rocket that came in the kit, and you took their scent and rifled it from your stand. I almost got beamed in the head in Buckhorn National Park one morning with a frickin' lead thing that probably would have killed me if it would have hit me in the head. The scent shuttle, it was called. You probably, it might be.
Wasn't there one that used to go on the end of
the arrow? Yep, that was something Wick, I think. Another great one that.
Would that be a trend or would that be a product?
That was a one-year frickin'.
Oh, I guess it's probably the same thing.
What's that?
Skunk scent.
Dude, when I first started, skunk scent was religiously the cover scent.
Yeah.
And then one year I couldn't find it. Then I went to earth scent. I couldn't find it. so I didn't use any scent, and I seen more big deer and animals ever before, and I never used any cover scents or any shit ever since. You get handicapped or you think that you put this magic shit on and you're bulletproof, or you put a suit on, you're bulletproof. Play to win. Read the sign. It's not rocket scientists. Just
that's where I'm going to come out and flat out say it, man. The whole scent lock thing. My hat is off to these guys because they're marketing geniuses. But the concept and the thought behind that you can wear an item of clothing that contains some traces of carbon is going to eliminate your scent is the biggest bunch of bullshit you'll ever hear.
We shouldn't say that.
I mean, it is. But I'm just saying. Like, I'm just trying to be real with everybody. It's, like I said, awesome for marketing, but, like, dude, ditch it. So many guys get so hung up on like having that suit, and they think that then they can cheat the wind.
He'd be a good one on because he deals with dogs. Yeah. How minute of a scent them damn things can smell is unbelievable.
I guess the one thing that gets lost in the argument with scent reduction, like I don't think scent lock really works, but I think like there's a benefit to like less odor is better than more odor.
Right.
So, and I'm 100% can tell you that my dog, based on the odor concentration, tells me how far away the person is. So if you can throw a monkey wrench into that equation where the deer has trouble, the deer, once it detects odor, it has to solve the problem. And the solution of the problem is, okay, how far away is this person and am I in trouble? So if we give them a super easy equation where it's, you know, you're upwind and they walk into the entire way, they're going to solve that quickly and come up with that they're in danger. But if you give them a complicated equation with, like, off winds are complicated equations and other situations like that where you're kind of playing with things, they might get a little bit of odor, but they're not sure exactly where it's coming from or how far away it is, and they have to make a decision. Like, just because they detect human odor doesn't mean they're automatically gonna bolt. They have to decide whether or not they think they're in trouble, and it matters what the environment is, you know, deer around houses. And I'm 100% sure, and you can probably, because you went after more single deer than me, I'm 100% sure they can scent discriminate where if they have a negative encounter with you, I'll have a way easier job killing them than you are, because he's going to be on high alert to your odor.
When they get your number, they become an unkillable beast where they'll actually, they'll win you. I had a buck on the property that would literally come through, you get wind of me, and he just beat the fuck out of the biggest tree right there that morning, just let me know that I got your shit and you ain't getting me again. So they're smart, smart animals.
See, the problem with all the dog studies they do is the dog's trained to detect the lowest amount of human odor and track it to the source of that odor, which is something the deer will never do. So, like, a deer may detect that lowest detectable amount and not alert, but the dog's trained to track it to the source of that odor. So they react differently. And so all those, the dog studies are, there's nothing wrong with the studies, but the conclusions are flawed because they're assuming that the dog would take a longer amount of time to find a person with a lower amount of odor than a person with a lot of odor. And that's wrong because, like, everybody's smelled marijuana before. So if I fill this room with the odor of marijuana and place a small amount of marijuana in the room, the dog would have an extremely difficult time finding the source of that odor in an area containing a tremendous amount of odor. So that's where the studies kind of go awry, where they're trying to correlate odor concentrations, the time it takes the dog to find the source of the odor.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is the whitetail can smell really, really good.
But they still have to make a decision.
Right. But I'm saying is if there's any volume of air coming from you, their direction, no matter what's going on, they can pick it up. The only way they can't if that volume is not. So if this whole deal was a negative air room and it was sucking all out that direction, complete molecules that direction, and a deer was up here, he probably couldn't smell you. If he's anywhere down there, any little bit of it, he's, whether you're covered in a plastic bag or a scent lock suit or whatever, he's going to get a little of your smell. They're that, it's that good of a nose. So,
use that fact that you're not leaving your scent behind in the way you approach your clean scent.
Yep.
Or the morning.
I'm not a big. For going in that one kill, but you got to remember, so just think about it. If I'm walking all over the place and I'm leaving all that scent, what I do, because I know where I left it and I find that spot, and then I work it to what I call a virgin sit. So where I'm going to be setting up on that deer, there has not been any of my tracks. There's not any scent. This is the ambush. He knows I'm out there hunting. He's moving through, but when he's moving through that spot, he's not going to have a clue that I'm there, and that's my ambush site. And then tomorrow, so I used to make a joke about it on a lease I had to myself down in Illinois. These big deer would literally come out in the evening, freaking looking around like, where's that son of a bitch today? I know he's in here. And they're looking like they're on guard, but they got to move through. They're living there, and they got to go through it. And I'm going to be sitting in a spot that's going to be a complete virgin sit for them. They're not going to have a clue I'm there. So, and just keep bumping and moving. And
can you say, like, how far? So, like, one of the things you told me was always interesting is, like, it doesn't have to be, like, 200 yards over there. It could be 60 yards. Mm-hmm. It could be 40 yards. It could be 80 yards off of where you had sat before, right?
Yeah. So here's a perfect example. I don't know if you've, some of your parents told you stories about how the Indians used to hunt. They'd walk through a fresh snowed area, and then they would hunt their back trail, and they would kill these big bucks. These bucks, you'd come into their terrain, they'd pick up your track, and they would walk you out till they felt comfortable that you were gone. Same thing going in the morning. The worst thing you can do is sneaking around, making a little noise, and then not making a little noise. If you stayed steady and walked through and in and out, a deer will spot you, listen to you, get you get out of there, and he'll go about his business. As soon as you stop and he loses track of you, you create a problem, and it could be the same thing with scent. So if you're, you got a constant blow, he knows you're there, he's not coming that direction. But like he said, a little bit of mount, you're walking all over there, the farmer's in there, you're driving bikes. If he lives there, he's gonna run into some human scent along the trail.
And I think, too, like going back to like scent and what you're doing and how you're playing that, if you focus on the wind, and I get minimizing your scent, and nobody wants to spray themselves down with perfume or whatever and go out there. Obviously, you don't want to make yourself a red flag, but if 90% of the people out there spent as much time playing the wind and just trying to hunt like they should versus trying to rely on gadgets and scent lock suits
100%.
And carrying all that extra bullshit and taking more time to set up, they'd be killing deer. Like a lot.
But I'll add this to that, just like you mentioned. Don't get us wrong. Good hygiene and less scent is better to control it. So you want to be that the least amount you can, and then don't think anything you're going to do is going to save the day and then play the wind to a tee.
Yeah, like
that's your recipe
for
the best that you can do.
I talk to people all the time that try and claim to me that they can hunt, they can literally beat a whitetail's nose with an Ozonics, and they've seen it a million times, and I call bullshit every time because it's not going to happen. You might, a lot of this stuff is happening in the rut, and these bucks are cruising through, and they might even think that their wind is doing what that's doing, and maybe in a vacuum.
Or the wind's blowing over the top of them, and they didn't even get it.
There's so many variables.
That's a lot of things. Just get it in your head that their nose are unbeatable, and then you beat them the way you can. You just keep your scent away from them. And
when you guys have reached the caliber of deer that you bull killed, what's your new goal? How do you decide to set your goal when you reach that level?
Good question.
What's your goal? 205, 204 and change?
Well, 216 non typical, but
world record. You're always here.
Yeah, but
I've been shooting for a world record typical all my life.
What's the highest scoring buck you shot?
216 is a non typical.
Okay, so then if how do you where do you go from there?
220.
You want that?
Matter of fact, there might be a 220 running around this year. So if he comes by, he's getting it.
That typical, that 204, right?
Oh yeah, I mean that's. That's my lifelong dream. It's always been to have a shot at a world record typical.
But you don't pass up 170 that walks by, like because you're waiting on a 220.
I've passed up many of 170s.
Well, I'm talking about. I'm not talking about that.
And it wasn't because I was waiting for a 200. It was because I was waiting for 180 or something or 190 or so.
I think the point being is like if you don't know that there's a 220 there, even though it's your goal to.
So here's what I'm where I'm at now.
Shoot something.
So you're running out of rope as far as class of animals because they don't get much bigger. They do, but for them to be on your property is tough. So if a net Boone and Crockett comes along, that's I got three tags every year in my pocket I could fill. $3 every year if I wanted to. I don't. But if a net 170 or now the new chase is the 200 or a 200 on a property, then I'm down for a two. Or if I got new broadheads this year I'm field testing, I might freaking shoot some ragracks just to get them out of the gene pool and practice up with the new tip. So that's my goal. What is yours?
Mine?
I just want to shoot one bigger than the year before?
I just want to shoot. My goal is to shoot Pope and Young every year. I think that's attainable for me in the Southeast. It's what I want to do. I'm not chasing some giant score. I've not reached that point in my life yet because I haven't shot a bunch of booners. But, you know, for me, I look at the region that I'm in, what's attainable for me to realistically chase based on where I can travel and where I can go to. And, you know, if I get the opportunity to shoot something bigger than what I've shot before or get on one like that, yeah, I'm going to chase it. But am I going to opt out of shooting something for a season because it's not bigger than the buck I shot the previous season? No. If it's the best deer in the area, then that's the deer I'm going to shoot. And if it's mature, which I try to hunt age over rack size most of the time, like if I know it's 4 years old and it's a good deer for my area, then I'm going to hunt it. You know? So that's how I go.
I don't think you're ever going to be happy. I think you're happy for like a day.
Yeah.
And then, like if you shot the world record, would that slow you down?
I think I'd be happy with that. I really seriously think I would be happy with that.
You just hang
I don't know if I'd slow down, but I'd be happy with it.
You'd be happy, but I think you're always looking.
Would you look at it and go...
The great thing about that deer is out there. They're finding sheds every year, and some guy's going to have the opportunity to hold that title someday. It'd be love to have a crack at it.
I got too much Wisconsin in me. Something fires me up, it's getting an arrow.
Yeah.
I shot a really good.
You're in the process of just filling up the wall now.
Not even. Sometimes I'm just, you know, filling the freezer. I like shooting.
I don't know.
So are you famous enough that people contact you about a big buck on their property?
I had a world record typical once on a property, and an outfitter wanted me to set him up to shoot the deer. And I says, if you think you got the fucking tools to go after that animal, you go do it. But if you think I'm putting you on a freaking world-class deer, it ain't happening. So make the choice. Do you want me to go after the deer or you want to go after it? They're just trying to make a name for yourself. You shoot a deer of that class, they'd have, booked up hunts for. And with the outfitting deal, there's another thing. I used to take advantage of outfitters having good land. And with some of the guys that I would deal with, I says, when you're done for the season and your guys are all through, I wouldn't mind leasing that property for a late season hunt. And then I could go in and I could have the whole thing to myself and hunt it. So there's a way you can get access to some pieces. Unguided type hunts. There's no way I'm giving up. I actually screwed you out of a big one too, didn't I? So. I'm still looking for that frickin'.
Prior to what you guys may think, it's not rainbows and blowjobs. Over at the farm, it's kind of cutthroat. So,
Do
deer use J hooks to try and detect?
Usually to go into their bedding site or to. Let's say if you wanted to do a drive, a deer likes to run off with the wind in its face to start with. And then it's going to do a big loop back around. So you can manipulate, when you're talking about J-hooks, usually people talk about that going into a bedding site. So we used to do two-man drives with the bow and kill whitetail all the time. And you'd push the deer, you'd push it this way, and the guy right next to you would end up getting the kills that would do a loop around and then start heading the way it wanted to head, you know. So knowing and understanding how they move through and feed helps a lot with that.
Bow.
54 pounds.
Yeah, poundage. Just says
I like feathers over veins. I like fixed blades over expandables. I'm not a huge weight guy, but heavier up front. Weight forward center makes a more accurate, consistent arrow. So, and I'm not a big shooter at all. I pick up my bow a week before the season, and sometimes I don't shoot it halfway through the season. I just want to make sure that it's on and it's accurate. And I'm not a guy that likes to just shoot for fun. So.
And I know we got a couple.
Go ahead, guys. Now you guys are shooters.
Yeah. Anybody want to add?
What do you got for a setup? You're an archery guy.
This is.
So I shoot a heavy arrow setup just for, you know, and it's one of those conversations where you're never going to win if somebody opposes your argument. I mean, there's good and bad to just about every decision. Heavy arrow, good penetration, you know, it's gonna, your yardage is gonna drop off. You know, same thing for mechanicals, fixed blades. It's hard to have a conversation with anybody that's opposing it because they all work in the perfect scenario. And I struggle this every day because people will ask me, you know, what should I do? You know, and I first try to figure out, you know, what you want to do as a hunter. Is it short? Is it long? You want speed, penetration? If you figure all those questions out, you should be able to, you know, strategically figure out your setup that's going to be perfect for you. And no perfect setup for me is the same for anybody else. I guess that's.
I like forgiveness on all my equipment.
I would probably say.
Oh no.
I was gonna say like, I think I agree with that, but I also think that like, when I'm looking at my bow and arrow setup, I want to have something that I'm not worried about, like whether it's, you know, whether I think it's cool. I just want it to kill what I'm shooting at. Like my goal in the woods is to not have potential error. So like for me, like I run a heavier arrow, like Andre said, or
Zenner.
That's a tough one.
I'm struggling right now. Yeah, you guys definitely need name tags. I like front of center weight. I run a high quality fixed blade, two blade broadhead, sharp. And, you know, I want to feel confident that if I have to take like a quartering two shot, if I have to take a shot where I'm going to hit something in the shoulder, if I make a mistake, because I'm definitely not perfect, that I'm going to feel okay that arrow is still going to perform the way I need it to perform. If there's chance for error that's outside of my capability spectrum, then, you know, I don't feel comfortable taking that out of the woods.
So speed doesn't kill, right? Accuracy kills.
See, we're the total opposite. Yeah. We shoot light arrows.
I shoot a 400 grain arrow. I have a 30-inch draw, so I'm lucky. I get a lot of energy out of that bow. Mm-hmm. But I shoot a 400 grain arrow. I'm shooting about 13% front center. I shoot iron well, a sharp, a razor sharp. And I'll say
this guy can shoot.
I've gone through every part of a deer that I've ever shot through. I've never left an arrow in the deer where it hadn't poked out the other side.
I shoot the original Lobo, that is maxed out at 45 pounds, and I smoke that thing through deer. Yeah. And it is a light arrow.
But I think one of the things, too, and I don't know if you guys...
You're not losing energy with an expandable, though.
No.
Right?
No, I was going to say that. Yeah, they're shooting fixed blades. I was going to say that's
Iron Will and Ramcat.
There's a catalyst there that's like with your people overthink. You don't need a 550 or 600 grain arrow to kill a deer.
Flat shooting arrow.
You need a well tuned bow is what you need at any poundage.
I don't care how heavy your arrow is. If it's coming out of that bow tail high and hits that deer, you're going to deflect.
If it's accurate and are you guys shooting expandables? I think that across the board, we would agree that sharp fixed blade broadheads kill better than your expandables because there's less risk associated with you shooting something. You also lose less energy. That's data. That's science.
There's nothing better than a good expandable blood trail.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's the
original plan of the arrow right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not that they don't kill stuff, because they do. But there's that.
I had all kinds of blood trails. I followed them all over the place and never ended up with the deer at the end, so I went back to the good old fixed one.
I just don't want to lose the yardage.
Yeah.
Like, I've shot heavy arrows. I tinker with my bow more than I tinker with anything. I've built arrows up to 700 grains.
This guy.
I do not want to lose. If that deer goes from 25 to 32 yards and I misjudge it, I don't want to hit that deer low.
Flat shooting.
So, yeah, I want something flat to about 23 yards, which I like to be around 290.
So what we weighed mine, right? The other 340? What was it? Or no, not 340. What was
340
it?
Would be like no broadhead.
No, it was like
420?
Velocity Pro should be around 400 grains or so.
But the science is out there. The science is out there. There is a weight of an arrow that's best, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So, but that makes a good point. Like, I don't have to move my pin out to 35 yards, like at a target, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you just kind of shoot top of the pin, bottom of the pin. You gotta shoot.
Well, and it also depends on, like, what your distance is that you're shooting, right? Like, so he's trying to maximize the distance that he's trying to capitalize on those whitetails at. If you're like Cody and you only shoot stuff at 4 yards, it doesn't matter. You could shoot an 800 grain arrow.
Yeah.
But it, you know, for 15 yards. But the, like Andre's talking about, the science is out there. Like, I'm sure anybody listening to podcasts, like, there's Ashby stuff that you can look up. There's a lot of science around.
650 for that.
But even so, like, it's just it's data around the penetration of which broadheads and which arrow setups perform better, and then you can interpret that and scale it down. My arrow's 484 grains.
That's probably the best weight to be out of anything for whitetail, I say, or for penetration.
It's just right in the middle. Like, it's not going
to... You have a good, happy medium between speed and mass.
Yep.
Because when it comes down to getting an arrow to stop, momentum is more important probably than kinetic energy. It's what it's going to take to stop that arrow when it hits, you know? If you have a sharp broadhead, it's going to make it a lot harder to stop that arrow.
Yeah.
And that leg bone, I don't care how many pounds you're pulling, if you square shoot that leg bone, you're screwed. Like, you may break it, but I don't think you're going to go all the way through it. You know, like, in that big part of the femur, you know?
Yeah, I don't see that happening either. I don't know. Yeah. I've heard that.
Unless
get your bow shooting tunes, nice straight arrow, and you should be fine. 15-yard shot, broadside.
I haven't shot the single bow.
I mean, going back to what I said, like, none of us here agree about
yeah.
Only thing we agree on, though, is...
Well, this is more so... This was more so the question.
And a fixed blade.
And it really depends on what you want. You want speed, you want penetration, you want distance, you want...
A well-tuned bow shoots itself, that's what they say.
Yes.
It's very forgiving.
And I think that's part of it. Like, a lot of people with a bad, poorly tuned bow go to an expandable because it flies like a field tip.
Yeah, but if the arrow's still flying sideways, it's a bigger disaster then.
It makes things worse in the end.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What's a piece of advice you wish you would have had when you made that jump from shooting like good deer to chasing a really big deer?
See, I was screwed. That's where it's weird for me. Coming up, like I came up, that's all I seen was giant deer on the wall. Even when I was introduced to hunting, and anywhere I go, anything I see, it's been just burned into my head of these world-class deer that, to me, seem normal. So when I started to hunt, like, that's just what I want. That's, like, what I was looking for. Whereas I wish, you know, like, size or caliber of deer didn't mean as much as it does to me. I'm not going to bullshit you. It does. I want something big. I just, you know, I'm obsessed with the sport. I'm obsessed with, like the whole, like, the primal aspect of it. I've talked to guys over here. Like, it's not about shooting bows for me. It's about, like, hunting, right? You know, as I step it up, like, yeah, I want bigger deer, but I also want consistency. I want to consistently kill deer, you know, and I want to consistently kill good deer.
So my first six deer were, like, four corns, three pointers, tiny little eights. You got to start out somewhere. You get a box of those, and then pretty soon you know what I mean. Yeah. And I guess that kind of did change things when you shot a Pope and Young, and it hit that score, and it was that deal. That was the thing that just, I guess, took it to. Now you love the sport, but it took it to some way you could.
You could gauge your. You know,
yeah, and you can set a goal, and you can have a. You know, it's a good deal, man. Don't worry about size. Start out where you're at and enjoy what the hell you're doing.
Yeah, that was the thing I was going to say with the hunting industry, how it became, like, they're almost bashing people because you're not shooting a 160, 170.
Yeah, that's...
Like, if you only have a 140 on your property and you shoot that is an awesome deer. Like,
whatever you want to kill, yeah, it's...
Even if it's a Pope and Young, or if it's 110 inch.
Even if it's not a Pope and Young, it's a white tail and you want it, and you're going to mount it.
That's like I said about right off the bat, maybe half hour ago, it's like, you got to. What do you want out of it? You got to ask yourself. You know, it ain't. Not everybody's the same, and I don't think there's.
Don't bash anybody for shooting small, and don't bash anybody for shooting big, because there's.
Because that's a big thing.
Whatever you
want
to do.
Everybody's
like,
oh, like, you know, you're shallow. You just want, like, well, you know, when you come to a time, I don't know. It's all about what you want. Nothing's wrong. Nobody's.
When I was hunting with Cody, he shot a deer, and he's like, dude, I really honestly think it's 130. He's like, I'm like, are you serious? He's like, dude, I'm happy right now. Like, I'm actually pumped. Like.
He kicked you off the leash, didn't he, for shooting something too small?
No, that's what I'm saying. When he shot. He thought it was. It ended up being a 160 inch deer. Like, he had it ingrained in his head that it was a 130 inch deer.
Well, I knew he was a shooter when he came through. I don't know if I said.
He's like, I think you did. Did he not?
Yeah, it's like to each their own. Yeah, if it trips your trigger, shoot it. But there's nothing wrong with wanting big, and there's nothing wrong with wanting old. I mean, but so.
What you want?
205 difficult.
Well, there you have it. All good times at the road show. The Q&A can get intense at times, a bit controversial, but we like to keep it laid back. I hope you got some good information out of this, and hopefully you guys will make it to one of the road shows this year and be on a future Q&A podcast. Have a good one. See you next week.